Welcome to Tilly's Trans Tuesdays. You may not know this, but in 2022, the largest survey of transgender Americans happened, and in February of 2024, the early report was released. So let's take a look at part one of the 2022 U.S. Trans Survey results. Hi, I'm Tilly Bridges, your host, and I'm joined by my writing partner, my best friend, my wife, our token cis representation, my favorite survey to fill out, Susan Bridges.
Hello. Cis isn't a bad word. If you think so, you've been listening to bad people. Stop that.
Oh, you haven't sung that song in a while.
Yeah.
Oh, it's always,
I feel like it's like...
It's always a good encore.
It becomes more necessary every episode.
And it should be less. It should go the other direction. Our guest this week is Charlie Hutchinson, a polyamorous trans femme non-binary social worker intern. After teaching middle and high school mathematics for over two decades, Charlie socially and medically transitioned in 2021 and has been working on completing their Master of Social Work. Charlie currently interns at the Gender Health Center in Sacramento, California, under the supervision of Dr. David Nyland, where she works with LGBTQ+ and BIPOC clients and participates in community advocacy. Her areas of focus are gender nonconformity, neurodivergence, and non-monogamy. Welcome, Charlie.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Okay, so I want to ask you, what sparked such a big career change from education into social work?
Coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic,
yeah,
the students had suffered a massive amount of trauma.
Yeah.
Schools had been closed down. They had watched their families go into panic. A lot of these students lost members of their family.
Yeah.
It was disruptive. It totally changed the dynamic of their lives. And then we came back and school administrators wanted to pretend it basically never happened. Students came back into the classroom. Teachers were instructed not to talk about the issues regarding the pandemic, not to talk about anything really beyond our curriculum. And I was teaching math,
yeah,
pre-calculus. Students in my class didn't need pre-calculus. They needed somebody to talk to them and let them know that the feelings that they were having were okay and to listen to what they were saying.
Yeah.
And so instead of pretending like everything was normal when it wasn't, I started looking for a new career.
Well, what was it about social work then specifically that let you know that was the thing you needed to do, where you wanted to go?
Right. I started looking into different forms of therapy. I had recently started my own transition and was working through early stages of navigating the system and finding access to care.
Yeah.
And so that combined, I originally looked at marriage and family therapy. I found online support group Stand in Pride. I posted my ideas there, and a whole bunch of people got in touch with me and offered assistance and advice. And ultimately, what I decided on was social work, because that allows me to work both at the micro individual level, the mezzo community level, and the macro national and state level. So through my internship, I work with individuals, I work with groups, I work with communities, and I work at the much larger scale. I've been involved in, I've presented at the UC Davis Mental Health Symposium, and I've been involved at Sac County Office working with their community in order to help advocate for transgender and LGBTQ individuals.
Well, I think it's really great that there are people out there doing that, because it's really hard being trans in the world right now. But we need, you know, that kind of help. But also, there's so many people that I've talked to, like trans people, who end up with therapists or even social worker help that the from cis people who just don't understand and they can't understand. And so it's really important that more of us are getting out there to do that, because no one's going to understand what we're going through as well as we do, right? So I'm really glad that you're out there doing that.
The first two therapists that I sought medical surgical letters from both ended up turning me down. One of them said that was a decision that they were not ready to make yet. So I'm very proud to be working at an agency that doesn't gatekeep.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a huge issue with that. We shouldn't even need letters, right? It should just be an informed consent thing everywhere. But for too many of us, that is not the case. Certainly wasn't for me. So, I had to prove my transness to a cis therapist in order to get access to hormone replacement therapy and everything. And it's awful. Nobody should have to do that.
Ultimately, I got one of my letters from Dr. David Nyland, who is the co-founder of the Gender Health Center. And that's the path that I found into my internship.
Excellent. Okay, so for you, what has been the best thing about transitioning?
Just being able to be myself. I had somebody ask me recently, when were the glory days of my life? And they are now.
They're now, absolutely.
I am living my best life. I am out and open about myself. I feel comfortable as myself in the first time in my life. And especially after receiving my surgery, I had a peritoneal pull through vaginoplasty last January. And in that year since, the overwhelming static that used to completely occupy my life is completely gone. I feel like I have extra capacity to do life.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me that you describe it as like that static, because I've heard a lot of people say that it's like this constant background noise that's always there, it's always bothering them, that's preventing you from fully accessing the world around you and yourself and your own emotions. And so that's fascinating. I'm so glad that it helped, though, that it cleared that up. That's amazing. And yeah, after a lifetime of just dealing with that and not getting to be yourself, just not having to pretend anymore or try to figure out how to be this cis person everyone said you were, it's this huge weight that gets lifted off, right? It's really amazing.
Right. It was like somebody took a 40-pound weighted backpack off my back that I didn't know was there.
Yeah, yeah. I've described it kind of similarly as well. Like my weight was a bit higher. I said it was like being trapped under a 400-pound weight on your chest and you can't get out and no one will help you. And you're just trapped there your whole life. So, yeah. Well, okay. So on the flip side of that, then, what has been one of the worst or most difficult parts of transitioning for you?
Well, as I mentioned, the gatekeeping that I had to go through as part of my medical transition. I had one therapist that I worked with who told me that I was too self-actualized to be I was too self-actualized to be one of her patients, that she preferred working with trans individuals that were earlier in their journey and still trying to figure themselves out. And so that idea that there has to be a correct way to be a trans person, the idea when I came out that I had to swing so hard to she, her, in order to meet the expectations and the guidelines to qualify.
Yeah.
That also was slightly uncomfortable. And since that point in time, I've settled much closer into my own non-binary identity. I used to identify with they, them pronouns before I transitioned. And so coming out, that idea that I had to be a she, her before I could qualify for some of these things.
Yeah. It's terrible that there's people out there still doing that. I mean, the field has advanced so much, and yet there's still so far to go, right? Like, even when you look at like the WPATH guidelines, version 8 is so much better than the absolute horror of version 1, but it still does not, it's not all the way there, you know? It's rough.
Right. You can't even find like versions 2 and 3 online. It's like they don't exist anymore.
I had a real trouble finding version 1, but I did. For folks listening, if you go back to the episode that we did, I don't have the number handy, but it was the one on transmedicalism where we talked about WPATH version 1. I copied the entire text of it and it is saved in the text and Google Doc versions of that episode. So if you go to tillystranstuesdays.com and look that one up, you can find it. I put it there because I'm not going to let that be lost. We need to remember what they put us through, what they did to us, you know, that we can't let them pretend it never happened.
And it was so difficult for me as a child. I grew up in the 80s, and none of this information was available and widely disseminated.
Right.
The best representation I could find for myself was the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is a challenging representation for a young trans woman.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have qualified for what at the time was gender identity disorder, GID. Yeah. I wouldn't have qualified. I didn't play with female toys growing up. I didn't cross dress in female clothing. I was attracted to women as a teenager, which would have disqualified me.
Yep.
And so there's been so much gatekeeping that it was only when informed consent became widely available that I was even able to begin this journey.
Yeah, it is really tough. I mean, there's so much gatekeeping, not even just medically, but like socially, in terms of, you know, it's all these cis people that are making the laws on what's required for us to change gender markers on our birth certificates or our driver's licenses. And in so many states in the U.S., you still can't do that if you haven't had surgery, bottom surgery, or in some places you still can't. You got to get letters. And it's just, it's like every aspect of our life is gatekept by cis people. And so, yeah, it is really tough. It's worth it for those listening, but it is tough.
I work with individuals doing name and gender change petitions at my agency. Yeah. And for people born in other states, there are some states where you just cannot get your birth certificate changed.
Yeah.
In some states, such as Texas, the language is worded in such a way that you cannot use a court order from California to change your birth certificate in Texas.
Wow.
Because in Texas, it says that the court order must state a sex change, not a gender change.
Right.
No court in California will issue that. In California, it's only a gender change petition. So it's deliberately set up to make it look like maybe there's a path forward, but there's still obstacles in that way that are blocking these people's access.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk a lot about access to things that are blocked in this survey. There's a whole lot to discuss. So let's get into it. In 2022, the National Center for Transgender Equality ran the largest ever survey of transgender Americans in an attempt to better see what life was like for us and to have hard data to use in policy decisions and fighting for our rights. It was a survey of trans people by trans people for trans people, and that it was being done by trans people is vital because, as we've seen all too often, cis people don't know what to look for, what to ask about, and often don't care, or worse, about helping us. For some examples of that in action within a medical context, see the Trans Tuesday on complete trans healthcare or lack thereof, available at tillystranstuesdays.com. Oh, and see it again. I mentioned it before, and I put it right in here. So here we go. See it again in the Trans Tuesday on Trans Medicalism and WPATH Standards of Care 1, which was episode 60 of this show. There it is, if only I'd read ahead. As a reminder, it's cis people taking away our health care. It's cis people gatekeeping our health care and legal name and gender marker changes. It's cis people trying to legislate us out of existence. So that the survey is being done by trans people is huge, because nobody knows our existence better than we do, and we're almost never consulted at all about laws, medical standards, or anything else that affects only us. It's the reason things like anecdotal trans health care is a thing, because cis doctors often don't care enough to, or outright refuse to, consult trans people on our own care. My own endocrinologist overseeing my HRT is operating on 30-year-old information. The Trans Tuesday on that topic was episode 20 of this podcast.
I couldn't even get an endocrinologist in my area to prescribe me HRT.
Oh my gosh.
My insurance tried several referrals and each one rejected me on the basis that they had no experience treating a transgender patient. I get
That's
mine through
terrible.
An OBGYN now.
Yeah. Wow. I know a few other trans people who don't even have, there's not even an endocrinologist in their area they can go to. It's just their GP has to do, and their GP doesn't know anything about it. And so they have to educate them every step of the way. If they even find one who's open to trying to learn, you know, along with them, it's the state of things is not great. Well, the state of anecdotal trans healthcare is so huge that if you follow me on social media, you probably saw how I wouldn't shut up about trying to get trans people to take this survey because it's so important. And on October 25th, 2022, the National Center for Transgender Equality posted, "For the first time in 7 years, you have a chance to be part of the largest survey of trans people by trans people in the U.S. Take 60 minutes to share your story and be a part of history." And then on November 4th, 2022, I quoted that with a post that reads, "Trans friends, this is super important. It's the best way for us to get a picture of trans life in the U.S. and is cited in lawmaking and policy decisions. If you are not cis, it's for you. It's long. It'll ask about discrimination and acceptance and so much more. Please take the time." So, Charlie, I wanted to ask you if you were aware of this survey and if you took it and had any sort of big thoughts about it.
Yes, I was aware of this survey. I participated in this survey. I had my partner participate in the survey. I posted it in the Slack at the agency I work at and encouraged all of the other interns to have their patients and clients work on that survey. I posted it in my surgical Discord and encouraged all of my friends to complete the survey. I put the word out as far as I could.
Yeah, same.
And yeah, it was a long survey. It took me about 60
so
minutes
long.
Also.
Yeah.
There were a lot of interesting questions. I talked a lot about my own adverse childhood experiences that I encountered as growing up closeted. And it did trigger a little bit of things for that.
Yeah, there were some tough questions. I mean, it's really important that we get this data, but it could be difficult at times to talk about some of these things. But note, for those of you listening, that the survey did take about 60 minutes to complete. It was absolutely huge and incredibly thorough, though I fear its length and questions about difficult topics kept participation numbers lower than they could have been. But I think it was necessary. The only way to truly find out what we transgender Americans are facing is to ask these questions. So they had to ask about everything in depth to gather what information they could. Even still, 92,329 trans people took the survey, and that is a huge data set. But there are far more trans Americans than that, and how many were even aware of the survey? How many of you cis folks out there were even aware of it? So I'm going to go through the entire thing and report on its findings, because I suspect most folks just haven't seen it at all. Keep in mind that the survey was so extensive that it took over a year to tabulate these results, and these are still just the early insights. Presumably, more in-depth results will be forthcoming. But even still, there's a ton of good data here. If you want to learn more about the survey, you can go to ustranssurvey.org. And if you just like to look over the results yourself, which includes information on the goals, methodology, outreach, who conducted the survey, and so much more, you can find a direct link to them in the show notes. All right. 38% of respondents were non-binary, 35% were transgender women, 25% were transgender men, and 2% identified as cross-dressers. It's fascinating to me that cross-dressers were even covered here, honestly. It can often absolutely be a gateway to transitioning, but it's also something entirely cisgender people do for reasons not related to being trans. But given so many trans folks, quote-unquote, ease into transition that way, I suppose it makes sense. But still, it surprised me. What were your thoughts about including cross-dressing in the survey, Charlie?
So I have, in my work and my personal experience, encountered several people that personally identified as cross-dressers early on in their transition.
Yeah.
They used it as a way to alleviate dysphoria without realizing that's what they were doing.
Right.
There are absolutely cis people that participate in cross-dressing for their own reasons, and those people are equally valid. And so that community kind of, it creates kind of a sense of, I don't want to use any disparaging language here, but it kind of closes itself off a little bit, and where people form a group identity there. And so it's like, I'm a cross-dresser, I do this for these reasons. And then 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, they're realizing, well, although I was part of that community and doing those things. It was for reasons related to my own dysphoria, and they're coming out. I've met several individuals who have come to my support group or I've met online that have told me a similar story, that they used to cross-dress, and that eventually it got to the point where that wasn't filling that need anymore, that they needed to come out further.
Yeah, I know several trans people the same way who thought they were only cross-dressers, and then sort of they were like, oh, wait a minute, that's not why I was doing this. So it did surprise me to see them included, but I think it was good that they were because so many of them do end up discovering that they are trans down the line. And they're going through entirely similar, but also their own things, at the same time. So I think it's good to get their perspectives on it too. Okay, so here's something interesting. When considering sex assigned at birth, the participation numbers shifted. 35% of respondents were trans women, and I guess that makes sense. As a group, we are very online. 30% were non-binary assigned female at birth, 25% were transgender men, 8% were non-binary assigned male at birth, and 2% were cross-dressers. But also, 5% of respondents reported that they were born with a variation in physical sex characteristics or had an intersex variation. 72% reported they were not intersex, and 23% reported that they did not know. I'm really glad intersex folks were accounted for, though. They're too often left out of everything involving gender and transness, and they shouldn't be. And this shows you, perhaps, how trans people can be more thorough and understanding of our own issues than cis folks might be.
All of these legislations that are coming through for gender-affirming bans all still have exceptions
Yeah, the
for
carve-out for.
operations on
Yep.
infants or intersex conditions. And so many people don't realize that they're intersex. The percentage of intersex
Right.
people is larger than most people understand or know. And so these 23% of people that don't know if they're intersex, we don't do these types of genetic tests because so many people would find out where they identify with their own phenotype at this point that they wouldn't, that knowledge could be very upsetting to them. So
Yeah.
I think our society does a huge disservice to intersex people.
It absolutely does. And that's a really good point that you mentioned too, like with the 72% that reported they were not intersex. I was one of those. But do I know for a fact that I'm not? No, I just don't believe that I am, but I've never been tested. Most people never have been. So the numbers are probably a lot higher than people think they are.
I feel a lot of intersex people are not comfortable talking about.
Sure.
And also, many times they don't even realize they had surgery as a baby
Right,
until they
they
hit
might not even
puberty.
know.
And oh, it seems like we guessed wrong. And now there's hormones and weird stuff going on. And it's all very confusing. And but it feels very secret. Like we don't hear about these people.
No, well, yeah, and like you,
And then everyone wants it to be a gender binary.
well,
So
right,
the
it's
laws are
like
about being
Charlie
a gender
said, that's why
binary.
the laws against gender affirming care for trans kids. That, they're all worried about these surgeries happening on trans kids, which don't happen, but they leave those carve-outs to force surgeries on intersex kids who cannot consent
Just to make sure they conform.
conform to the binary. Yeah, it's terrible. There is more data on the breakdown of age and race respondents that I'm not going to get into all the details of here, but 56% of the respondents were white and ages 18 to 24, 43%, and 25 to 44, 36%. Made up the bulk of all those categories, so the respondents were largely white and young, which sadly makes sense when you think about who has the easiest access to and time to fill out a very large online survey. Not that young, white, trans people have it easy in the world, but as a group, they face far fewer barriers than every other trans person does. For more on that, please see the Trans Tuesday on Trans Intersectionality, which was episode 10 of this show. Here's a stat that shocked me. 41% of respondents were in the South, as based on U.S. Census regions, and those are generally the states with the most oppressive anti-trans laws. I don't know if that's from the survey targeting them more to get a better idea of what they're facing, or from people living under the worst oppression working harder to be sure their voices are heard, or both, but it was a super interesting statistic to me. 28% did not see a doctor when they needed to in the last 12 months due to cost. I've talked many times about how trans people often face poverty due to losing our homes and jobs when we come out, but the survey has more info on that in a bit. More than a quarter of the people who took the survey couldn't afford to see a doctor when they were sick, which is horrible, and almost the same number, 24%, didn't see a doctor due to fear of mistreatment. Read the Trans Tuesday on complete trans healthcare or lack thereof. I mentioned before to learn how my own experiences with that went and realize that I have it good. What I've experienced is but a shadow of what many others go through. We shouldn't fear how cis doctors will treat us when we need medical care. I shouldn't even need to say that, much less talk about it. Is this a thing that you've encountered in the social work that you do, Charlie, where trans people's inability to access or fear of mistreatment in healthcare?
Inability to access, absolutely. We
And
partner with Legal Services of Northern California and do referrals quite frequently for people that are being denied access to care because of their trans identity. It's a huge issue. We also have a hormone clinic that we do in conjunction with UC Davis nurses for people that just cannot get access through their insurance as a stopgap measure.
Yeah. It's great that things like that are out there. I think a lot of cis people don't realize that for those of us who are on hormone replacement therapy, how important it is. Like if we lose access to our hormones, that's not just a, oh, well, I'll get them again when I can. I mean, it's going to mess up your body. It's going to mess up your brain and the way you think. And it's just going to, it's so important that we have access to those.
About 2 weeks off hormones and I go into menopause symptoms.
Yeah.
I have no way of producing my own sex hormones with my body anymore. This is something I have to supplement with for the rest of my life.
Yeah. 44% experienced serious psychological distress within the 30 days prior to filling out the survey. A clearer picture of what living in a highly transphobic society does to us you may never find. Of the people who did see a doctor in the prior 12 months, 48% reported having a negative experience because they were trans. This includes, quote, being refused health care, being misgendered, having a provider use harsh or abusive language when treating them, or having a provider be physically rough or abusive when treating them. Holy shit, that is unconscionable. 26% had at least one issue with their insurance company in the last year for things like being denied coverage for HRT and or gender confirmation surgeries, but some were also denied coverage of routine health care because they were trans.
And I mean, the state of U.S. insurance
is a nightmare. Yeah.
Like, I mean, even just trying to get your hormones, like, and switching prescriptions because, like, the insurance changed slightly. And so the provider changed slightly and couldn't figure out the dose of your medication. And then they sent you, like, it was a different viscosity and the needles didn't work.
Yeah.
It was just like, what? That was just like routine. Like, this is the U.S. It's just crap all around.
Yes.
Not to mention the other issues you could possibly be faced with.
Yeah. 94% reported that they lived at least part of the time as a gender other than the one assigned at birth, and 79% were, quote, a lot more satisfied, and 15% were, quote, a little more satisfied with their life. That's a combined 94% positivity rate when living as ourselves. 98% of respondents on HRT reported they were more satisfied with their life after. That is wild. How many other medical interventions do you know of that have that kind of positivity rate from people receiving it? 97% of respondents who had at least one gender confirmation surgery were more satisfied with their life after. These numbers are unprecedented. The regret rate for gender confirmation surgeries for trans people is 1%. According to the World Journal of Surgery, the average regret rate for all surgeries for all people is 14.4%. There's a link in the show notes.
And that's the average.
Right.
The regret rate for cancer treatment is 5%.
Yeah.
These are people that are having treatment for something that, if left untreated, will likely result in their own death. And that regret rate is 5 times higher than the regret rate for people receiving gender-affirming surgeries.
Yeah.
For things like knee replacement, I believe it's somewhere about 1/3.
Yeah. Some of them get really high because of the complications and, you know, the difficulties healing from it. And it's just, I think so many people don't realize that we know it's not a question of whether or not these work for the people that need them. They absolutely do. And there's withholding them from the people that need them is it's unconscionable. It's absolutely horrible.
And yet statistics like this are never really cited when they're debating these laws that are aimed at banning access. They'll bring in the same two or three detransitioned individuals that are constantly making the same loop and repeating the same stories over and over again each time. And they're in such a small percentage, but these are the people that are who are having their voices uplifted.
Yeah. And it's like you said, it's the same two or three people. They fly them around the country because there aren't that many detransitioners, you know, and of the few that are, most of them have no issue with trans people. It just they figured out, oh, I wasn't really trans, you know. And so, again, I've mentioned this in past episodes, but people who detransition because they're not actually trans aren't trans people. That's cis people making a mistake. So that really shouldn't be held against us anyway.
And I encourage the people I work with and other people in my life to explore their gender and their sexuality.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's perfectly fine to explore and find out that you're exactly where you started.
Exactly.
Then you know, and you're not taking society's standard norms as a default.
That's right. It can help you confirm how cis you are. You will never know if you don't test it, right? And then you'll find out, I really am cis. And then you'll know more about yourself. And that's really cool. But we are going to wrap it here for now. But please come back next week as we finish discussing the rest of the report. There's still so many more important bits of info that reveal a whole lot about trans life. Thanks for being here, Charlie.
Absolutely. It was great to join you.
Cis people still treat gender confirmation surgeries as some horrible thing that we don't know that we really want, but clearly we know what we need. If you just listen, things would be better for all of us. Tilly Bridges, End Transmission. Tilly's Trans Tuesdays is hosted by Tilly Bridges and Susan Bridges, with audio editing and sound mixing by Jillian Morgan. The Google Doc and social media versions of this week's topic and all past topics are available at TillysTransTuesdays.com. Special thanks to Daisy and Jane for the use of Sorry Not Sorry as our show's theme music. Please stop by and show your support at daisyandjane.bandcamp.com and soundcloud.com/daisyandjane. You can find me at Tilly Bridges on Blue Sky, Twitter, and Hive, on Mastodon at tillybridges@mastodon.social, at facebook.com/tillysbridges, and on Insta and Threads at heckyeahtillybridges. And you can find Susan on most of those at Susan L. Bridges. You can find Jillian at Audio Jillian on Blue Sky. You can join the Tillyverse Discord server by following the link at the very bottom of TillysTransTuesdays.com. We hold regular watch parties for the Matrix films and other trans movies, where I do a live Q&A, and it's blossomed into a wonderfully supportive, compassionate, kind community of friends. We'd love to have you join us. For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.